All right, good morning, everybody. Hope you're keeping yourself warm out there. It's a little chilly in here. We're going to do a little trivia. We always like to do a little trivia. I am going to ask you not to shout it out because I think a lot of you will get it on the first one. So just keep it to yourself. You can have your own sense of accomplishment if you get it with the first one. So the first clue about, we're going to talk about a book of the Bible today. We're basically going to cover a book of the Bible. And you are guessing, but not out loud, this book of the Bible. So the first clue is this is one of only two books in the Bible that does not have explicitly the word God in it. Now I'll give you another little kind of point B clue on that. I'm not going to cover the Song of Solomon. So kids, my kids can be relieved that I'm not going to cover that one today. Maybe another time. All right, that's the first clue. The second clue about this book is the major themes of this book read like a Hollywood script. There's a lot of hard partying, tempers flaring, political intrigue, lust, romance, good versus evil, and drastic, ironic, historic turns of event. The final clue is the name of the book is the name of a woman. And this woman's name appears in the Bible more times than any other woman. So probably most of you got it. We're going to talk about Esther. And I have two purposes today. My first purpose is really to go through it quickly. I know a year and a half or maybe 2 years ago we did it in the scripture reading. So for some of you, it's probably a year and a half, 2 years. I don't know how fresh that is. But we'll go through it. And some of you, most of you, it'll probably be a refresher. Some of you maybe don't know the story of Esther. And it's not going to be as boring as it may sound because actually the story's really, really good. And actually the way it's written is really good. And I'm not going to read all of it because we don't have time for that. But the characters, the plot, the literary quality, and the ultimate irony place this as possibly one of the most entertaining books of the Bible. And it's a story that Hollywood actually loves so much they made at least 5 major motion pictures out of it. So we'll do that. That's kind of the first thing. We'll cover it as a refresher. And hopefully it'll be both entertaining. And as we go along, hopefully you'll look for some lessons here. Because really the second and real purpose I have today is to show you 3 things from this book that I think it's really worth pondering and considering and applying in your life. So this is going to be a application in your life message. You know, we're starting a new calendar year in 2025. And because of that, and you know, the messages you probably hear around you, it's a time to reflect. And this book, I think, has 3 ways that it should encourage us to reflect in a way perhaps maybe we haven't in some time. So you're going to have 3 calls of action at the end on how to reflect starting this calendar year that come out of this book. All right, so we're going to read it. So you can follow along. Turn to Esther if you'd like. I'm going to read it in my favorite translation for a story, which is the New Living Translation, with a few new King James peppered in on verses that I think are, you know, the memory verses that many of us might have. So let's read it. I'll read it, and you'll notice that I'm paraphrasing as we go here. I'll try to make it as good a story as it is. So these events happen in days of King Ahasuerus, who many believe is Xerxes, but not for sure. In fact, the New Living Translation had Xerxes, but I don't want to put that in there because I think that's speculation. He reigned over 127 provinces stretching from India to Ethiopia. So if you have a picture in your mind of a map, that is a lot of land. India to Ethiopia, it was pretty much the empire of the world. It was Persia. In the 3rd year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, and he invited all the powerful people from his entire empire, and they celebrated for 180 days. 6-month grand celebration. And at the very end, and there was the purpose of this was to display the opulent wealth and the pomp and splendor of his majesty. At the end of this, they had a 7-day banquet where the whole city was invited to the king's courtyard, and there was no limits on drinks. This was a wild 7-day party. And at the same time, the queen, her name was Vashti, she gave a banquet in the royal palace for the women. Well, on the 7th day of the feast, when it says King Ahasuerus was in high spirits because of the wine, he asked his eunuchs to bring the queen Vashti to him with the royal crown on her head. And I won't put any commentary here. That could be very salacious. Maybe it wasn't. Who knows? He wanted the nobles and all the other men to gaze on her beauty, for she was a very beautiful woman. But when they conveyed the king's orders to Queen Vashti, she said, "I'm not having it. I'm not going. And this made the king furious, and he burned with anger. And he immediately consulted with his advisors, saying, what am I going to do about this? You know? You guys know all, because the Persians, they had these very specific laws and customs, and they had to follow them once they were written. What must be done to Queen Vashti, he asked it. What penalty does the law provide for a queen who does not obey the king's orders, even when we followed proper process? One of his advisors, Mumikin, answered the king and his nobles. He said, Queen Vashti is wrong, not only the king, but also every noble and citizen throughout your empire. These women. Women everywhere will begin to despise their husbands when they learn that Queen Vashti has refused to appear before the king. And before this day is out, the wives of all the king's nobles throughout Persia and Media will hear what the queen did and will start treating their husbands the same way. This is like a wildfire that's going to catch. A woman who does not follow her husband's directions. We can't let this happen. What will happen? All the things that will transpire. There will be no end to their contempt and anger. So if it please the king, we suggest that you issue a written decree that can't be revoked. And it should order that Queen Vashti will be forever banished from the presence of the king. And the king should choose another queen more worthy than she. And when this decree is published throughout the king's vast empire, husbands everywhere, whatever their rank, will receive proper respect from their wives. Great advice from his advisors. So they all thought it made good sense. They followed the counsel, and they did. They sent all these letters out proclaiming that the man should be the ruler of his own home and should say whatever he pleases. This is the translation from New Living Translation, which, again, I think there's a little bit of comedy included in here as well. Chapter 2. So it's done. Vashti's gone. Women can properly respect their husbands because they put that example to the side. It says in chapter 2, but after the king's anger had subsided, he began thinking about Vashti and what she had done and the decree he had made. Maybe I shouldn't have drunk so much. Maybe I shouldn't have done this. So his personal attendant suggested, we're going to find the whole empire. We're going to find a bunch of beautiful women, and we're going to bring them all in here, and you can pick a new queen. He liked that advice, and he did it. Verse 5, it says, at that time there was a Jewish man in the fortress of Susa, which is where the capital was, whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair. He was from the tribe of Benjamin and was a descendant of Kish and Shimei. We'll come back to that. His family had been among those who, with King Jehoiachin of Judah, had been exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. This man had a very beautiful and lovely cousin, Hadassah, who was also called Esther. So this is his cousin. When her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her into his family and raised her as his own daughter. So here we find that Esther is an orphan. We don't know what happened to her father and mother, but we know Mordecai, who was her cousin, served as her father's figure. And as a result of the king's decree, Esther was very beautiful. She was brought to the king's harem at the fortress and placed in Haggai, who was one of the main eunuchs' care. And Haggai was very impressed with Esther, and he treated her kindly. He gave her the best beauty treatments, the best food, and the top maid servants. Now, Esther was very careful not to tell anyone her nationality and family background because Mordecai had directed her not to do so. So here we start to see the first hint in this book that the Jewish people may be, you know, not as favored, maybe and perhaps discriminated against. And every day, Mordecai, he looked after this girl like it was his daughter, would take a walk near the courtyard to find out about Esther and what was happening to her. He cared for her. Now, before each young woman was taken to the king, she was given 12 months of preparation. And then he would call for each woman, and after that one night, she would never go to the king again unless he had especially asked for her and requested her by name. And when it was Esther's turn to go to the king, she accepted the advice of Haggai, who was in charge of the harem, and she asked for nothing except what he suggested, and she was admired by everyone who saw her. So here we start to see that Esther must have some kind of good character. And the king loved Esther more than any of the other young women. What a princess story here. He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet and declared a public holiday in Esther's honor. Even after all this, Esther continued to keep her family background and nationality secret, so no one knew. Verse 21, it talks about Mordecai. He discovers this plot of assassination of these two guys. He finds out about it. He lets Esther know. Esther goes to the king, reveals that he was about to get assassinated. They investigate it. They found out, yes, these two guys had done it. And Esther made sure that Mordecai got credit for it. And it got recorded. It says here, it got recorded in a book. That's important later also. Next it says in chapter 3, sometime later, the king promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, over all the nobles. So just like we mentioned Kish and Shimei with Mordecai, note that Haman also has a heritage, and we'll come back to that, making him the most powerful official in the empire. So, whatever reason, this guy Haman is now like the prime minister. King's more powerful, but other than him, it's Haman's the top guy. And all the king's officials would bow down before Haman to show him respect whenever he passed by, for so the king had commanded. But Mordecai refused to bow down or show him respect. And the palace officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why are you disobeying the king's command? You got to do this, man." And they spoke to him day after day, but he refused to comply with the order. So they went to Haman. They ratted him out. And they also ratted out that Mordecai was a Jew. Verse 5, it says, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not bow down or show him respect, he was filled with consuming rage. And he'd learned of Mordecai's nationality. So he decided it was not enough just to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Instead, he looked for a way to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire empire of Ahasuerus. So, in verse 7 it says, in the month of April, so this is translating to, you know, the calendar, Roman calendar, during the 12th year of the king's reign, lots were cast in Haman's presence. The lots were called Purim, to determine the best day in the month to take action. And the day selected was March 7th, nearly a year later. So 11 months out, so there's some time involved here. Then Haman took his request to the king. It seems like every time you see these two guys, there's some sort of alcohol involved. It doesn't say that here, but perhaps. He comes to the king. He's the prime minister, which means he's probably running all the affairs. The king, you know, rubber stamping a lot of things is what it implies. And Haman says, hey, there's a certain race of people scattered throughout all the province of your empire. They keep themselves separate from everyone else. Their laws are different from those of any other people, and they don't obey your laws. So is it not in the king's interest to not let them live? And if it pleases the king, we can issue a decree that they be destroyed. And oh, by the way, I will put 10,000 large sacks of silver to the government to be deposited in the royal treasury. So not much has changed in history. A lot of this was about money. Why would the king agree to this? Well, these people aren't obeying the laws. Did he look into it? I don't know. But Haman was going to make him far richer with what he was doing here. And, you know, this has all the shades of the Holocaust, you know, and this is kind of a premonition to that. Like, whether, you know, they were going to take all the wealth from these people. That's where the money was going to come from. The king agreed, says in verse 10, put his, you know, signet ring and giving it to Haman. And he says, go do as you see fit. So this decree was put throughout the land. It was, the order was that all Jews, so the decree itself actually spelled out what was going to happen. Haman wrote it. All Jews, young and old, women and children, must be killed, slaughtered, annihilated on a single day, and that was March 7th of the next year. And the property of the Jews would be given to those who killed them. So they're just going to take everything they had. And this decree went throughout all the land. And then it says in verse 15, and then the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa fell into confusion. Because it was an odd, I think a lot of people probably didn't understand what's going on here. And it seems like Haman was really making a lot of decisions. So, chapter 4. We'll read a lot of chapter 4 because I think this is one of the critical chapters, probably the critical chapter in the book. When Mordecai learned about all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on burlap and ashes and went out in the city crying with a loud and bitter wail. And as news of the king's decree reached all the provinces, there was great mourning among the Jews. They fasted, wept, and wailed, and many laid in burlap and ashes. Now Esther is in the palace. She doesn't know what's going on. She was kept in the dark. But her maids and eunuchs came and they told her about Mordecai. She was deeply distressed. And she sent clothing for him to change into out of the burlap, but he refused it. And then she sent one of the trusted eunuchs, Hathach, and she said, go find out what's troubling him. Why is he mourning? So Hathach went, met Mordecai in the square. Mordecai told him the whole story, including the exact amount of money that Haman had promised into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews, which is the reason the king's agreeing to this. Mordecai gave Hathach a copy of the decree issued in Susa that called for the death of all Jews, and he asked Hathach to show it to Esther and explain the situation to her. Which first, ignorance is bliss. She didn't know anything about this. Life was good for Esther, but she's about to have that all disrupted. Mordecai also asked that Hathach should direct her to go to the king to beg for mercy and plead for her people. So Hathach returned to Esther with Mordecai's message. You can almost picture this. I mean, it's chilling to get that message, and you're the queen. And we don't know how old Esther is, but she's not that old. Late teens, early 20s, I don't know, but she's not that old. And Esther told Hathach to go back and relay this message to Mordecai. All the king's officials and even the people in the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his gold scepter. And the king has not called for me to come to him for 30 days. So Esther basically says, look, what you're asking me to do is probably my death sentence, Mordecai. I can't do that. Besides, he's not that interested in me. He's hanging out with Haman a lot more than me. So Hathach gave Esther's message to Mordecai, and we come to the most famous verses of this book, and we'll come back to these verses. Verse 13, Mordecai sent this reply to Esther. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Verse 15, it says, then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go and gather together all the Jews of Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. 3 days. We do a day of atonement 1 day. 3 days is a lot. My maids and I will do the same. And then, even though it's against the law, I will go in to see the king. And if I die, I die. So Mordecai went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Now here it's a great example, we'll come back to this, of Esther she just makes her mind up, I'm going to do it. We get to chapter 5, as this starts to build to a climax in the story. On the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes and entered the inner court of the palace, just across from the king's hall. Illegally, she was not invited. The king was sitting on his royal throne, facing the entrance. And I love how this book describes the king, because see, he's very temperamental, the way they describe him. So who knows what's about to happen? When he saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out the gold scepter to her. Whew. So Esther approached and touched the end of the scepter. And the king asked her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What's your request? I will give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom. Esther's quite clever here. I love how, you know, she's probably directed by God here to be actually pretty clever of how she goes about this. She says, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to a banquet I prepared for the king. King thought that was a great idea. Get Haman, let's go. So they went. And while they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, now, tell me what you really want. What's your request? I'll give you up to half the kingdom. And Esther replied, this is my request and deepest wish. If I have found favor with the king and it pleases the king to grant my request and do what I ask, then please come again tomorrow with Haman to another banquet I will prepare, and I'll explain all about it. Oh, the irony in all this. Haman was a happy man as he left the banquet, but he just couldn't be happy long enough because there's that Mordecai guy sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling nervously before him, and Haman became furious. However, he restrained himself and went home. He gathered together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, and he boasted to them about his great wealth, his many children. He bragged about the honors the king had given him and how he'd been promoted over all the other nobles and officials. And then Haman added, it's not all. Queen Esther invited only me and the king himself to the banquet she prepared for us. And she has invited me to dine with her and the king again tomorrow, twice. Then he added, but it's all worth nothing as long as that Mordecai the Jew is just sitting there at the palace gate. This guy bothers him so much, he can't even enjoy all his great things. So, great idea came from his wife and his friends. Hey, set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall, and in the morning, ask the king to impale Mordecai on it. Gruesome, you can almost picture this pole that he's going to build. I don't know why it had to be 75 feet. I think 7 feet would have done, but anyways. And when this is done, you can go on your merry way to the banquet with the king. Haman thought, great idea. And he got this pole all built and set up. Tomorrow's going to be a great day. Oh, but that night the king had trouble sleeping, so he ordered one of his attendants to bring a book of the history of his reign so it could be read to him. This guy liked to, you know, hear about himself. It's the only way he could sleep is if he could just hear about his own reign and how great he was. So they brought in this book, and they're reading it, and they read this whole thing of how Mordecai exposed this plot that we read about earlier. And He says, what reward did we give that guy? Nothing. We didn't do anything. We just kind of moved along. And just then, the king says, hey, who's that in the outer court? Well, it happened to Haman. Haman came early for his good day. He arrives outside, and he's just about to ask the king to impale Mordecai on this pole that he built. Before he could even do it, you know, the attendants told the king, Haman's out there. The king says, bring him in. Haman came in, and the king said, before Haman could get his request in, the king said, hey, Haman, wise man, what should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me? Of course, Haman thought, he's talking about me. He wants to honor. Who would he wish to honor more than me? So Haman says, oh, if the king wishes to honor someone, he should bring out one of the king's own royal robes, dressed like the king, as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden. Basically, impersonate the king. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, and let him see that the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed just like that and marches around the city. And as they go, shout, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. Man, Haman had everything. Now he could get this too. Excellent, the king said. Quick, take the robes and my horse and do just as you said for Mordecai the Jew. You can imagine Haman's face here of horror. This is not what he was expecting. And leave out nothing that you have suggested. So, verse 11, Haman took the robes, put them on Mordecai. His great day is not starting out well. He placed him on his king's own horse, led him through the city square, shouted, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the palace gate. Haman hurried home dejected and humiliated. His wife says, bad news, Mordecai, he's humiliated you. Jewish birth, you never exceed. It will be fatal to continue opposing him. So we're now foreshadowing that even his wife is like, Haman, things are not going to go your way. While they're still talking, the eunuchs come, the king's eunuchs come, and they say, hey, banquet's ready. Come to this next banquet. So the king and Haman go to Queen Esther's banquet. And once again, while they're drinking wine, the king said to Esther, okay, so what is this you really want? Queen Esther replied, if I found favor with the king, and it pleases the king to grant my request, I ask that my life and the lives of all my people will be spared. For my people and I have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. Now, if we had merely been sold as slaves, I would remain quiet, for that would be too trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king. Who would do such a thing? The king demanded. Who would be so presumptuous as to touch you? Esther replied, this wicked Haman right here beside me is our adversary and our enemy. And Haman grew pale with fright before the king and the queen. The king jumped to his feet in a rage and left. He was so angry, he couldn't even stand to be in the room. And Haman saw that this was bad news. And so he threw himself on Queen Esther, when she's begging for her, you know, please say something to the king. Well, just then the king walks back in, and here he is on his queen. The king is even angrier. Will he even assault the queen right here in the palace before my very eyes? And as soon as the king spoke, the attendants knew what to do. They covered Haman's head, signaling his doom. And right then, Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, had a great idea. Hey, Haman set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall in his own courtyard. He was going to impale Mordecai with it, the one who saved your life. And the king said, great, let's impale him on it. So the irony, Haman had built this pole, and it turned on him, and he was impaled on it. And on the same day, it says, the king gave the property of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai was brought before the king. Esther finally admitted how they were related. And the king took off his signet ring when she had taken back from Haman and gave it to Mordecai. So Mordecai took Haman's place. And Esther appointed Mordecai to be in charge of Haman's property. And it says once again, Esther came in. And because this was a formal decree, Esther comes in again and pleads for her people again. And a new decree is written, which basically you can't undo the old decree. So the way the new decree was written is basically the king said, look, if people try to attack you on March 7th, you have a right to fight back and kill them, and that would be legal. So that's basically what it was. So the Jews were filled with joy and gladness and are honored everywhere. When the day came, the Jews were spared. Many of their enemies were not. Haman had already been killed. His 10 sons also were killed. And the book wraps up describing that this was a turning point for the Jewish exiles. And then a secular holiday of Purim was commemorated to remember it. Now, that's kind of the end of the story here. What's cool about this book, there's lots of things, but one of them is that most scholars consider this book to be one of, if not one of the greatest literary works of the Bible. There's all kinds of things, and I don't have time to go through all the different, and I'm not a literary expert, but all the different things that are going on in this. First of all, it's well written to be colorful. But beyond that, there's all kinds of literary devices that are used in here. One, I'll talk about a couple. One is paired events. They do this pairing of events, which was a literary tool that was used. Nearly every event in Esther happens twice, if you notice it. The second time was always a variation on the first. You know, the first chapter, there's a long banquet, and then there's the short banquet. Esther comes twice unannounced to the king. Haman goes home with his head covered, and after giving honor to Mordecai, but then his head is covered before the king. You know, if you notice, if you go back and read this, there's lots of little pairs, and they're almost the same, but not exactly the same. And paired events are one of the motifs of this book, and this is going to be an important point later on. We're going to revisit this. The second thing that's another literary tool that's used in here is ironic reversals, and you can kind of see that. There's a lot of irony in here, and it's related to the paired events. You know, the king commands Vashti to come before him. She refuses, and she loses her position. But Esther comes before him uncommanded and at the peril of her life, but gains position. That's an ironic reversal. Mordecai, here's another example. Mordecai, a Jew, he refuses to bow to Haman. But then later, Haman bows before Esther when he's pleading for his life, a Jew. Haman is lifted up by the king and then humbled. The Jews fast and then they feast. Ironic reversals are also important. We'll look at that later. There's more than that. You can do a study on this book, and there's a lot of literary gems in how this was written. And you can start to see by some of that Esther's a deeper book than meets the eye. But what purpose do all these literary devices serve? Was somebody just showing off their talent? No. The answer is that they underpin the central message of this book, which is the invisible, mysterious, hidden, but unflinching providential care of God for his people. You know, one of the great mysteries and, frankly, criticisms of this book is that, like I said earlier, it's one of two books in the Bible where God is not mentioned. So we read all that, and nowhere do you see Jehovah, Yahweh, God mentioned. Why is that? Did you notice that before? It's odd, isn't it? Why wouldn't it be mentioned? Because you feel like after you read it, you would have seen his name in it. I actually think the writers told the story this way on purpose. Why? Well, that leads to our first big reflection that I want you to have coming out of this message from this book. The first big reflection as we start a new calendar year. And that is, God may seem invisible. He may seem like he's not present. But he is with you, and he will keep his promises. And you know, in this day and age, it may seem like that more and more. You know, we long for the days like the New Testament where God's presence was so visible through miraculous healings, you know, speaking in tongues, appearing visibly or audibly to the apostles. You know, you read Acts and you say, man, why can't it be like that now? I mean, it might even seem like God's just not involved in this era. And to me, that is one of the great lessons we can learn from this book. Here we have God's people living in a foreign land, dominated by those who were opposite of God. And God's presence must have felt distant to them in some ways. But they had his ancient promises that he would save them. And repeatedly throughout the Old Testament, God promised to never allow his people to be completely destroyed. And you know, God has made us the same promises, us as spiritual Israel today. If you would turn to Romans 8, we'll just look at some of these. We could turn to a lot of scriptures here. Romans 8, and I'm going to read verses 24 through 39. I'll skip a few verses as we go here. But listen to these promises that we have. Just like in the days of Esther, they would have had all these promises in the Old Testament. These promises are for us. It says in verse 24, for we were saved in this hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. It's invisible. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. In verse 28, which is another memory scripture, it says, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. We're going to come back to his purpose as we go along here later. In verse 31, it says, then what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? And this is written to us, spiritual Israel. He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. And I love it in verse 35. It says, well, then who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress, stuff many people in the room are feeling, persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? In verse 38 it says, for I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is Christ Jesus our Lord. What a set of promises. And in verse 24 it says, this hope, these promises we have, they may be invisible, but they are certain. And when you read the book of Esther, even though God's name isn't specifically mentioned, is it not so obvious that God is guiding each circumstance, each tiny little detail, to work to his glory and to save his people in miraculous fashion? You know, his fingerprints are all over the story. So the first action you have today is to reflect on this. What about you in your life? Is God's fingerprints all over your life? Do you ever get discouraged or feel like God is just not involved or he's invisible? We all do at some point in time, but reflect on that now. Challenge you to do this. When you reflect, look at your life. Really inspect the different ways that your life has ebbed and flowed. Why are you sitting here right now? I'm willing to bet if you do that, you will know in your heart that your God has worked in invisible and mysterious ways, and that the promises made to Israel, and later spiritual Israel, as we read in Romans 8, are as true today as they were in the story of Esther. So, but why isn't God's name mentioned in this book? We didn't really answer that. Well, the writer of Esther, I think, like I said earlier, purposely hid his name to provide this message of God's invisible help. God was there the whole time. You just needed to look below the surface. Funny thing is, as scholars have dissected this book, they found something curious. God's name is actually in the book. You just have to look closer. A popular literary trick used by Jewish writers was something called an acrostic. Does anybody here know what an acrostic is? I didn't know this before this, but you know what an acronym is. Acrostic's like an acronym. An acrostic is where you either take the first letter of a phrase or the last letter of a phrase and put them together to form a new word, like an acronym. And at four of the most pivotal moments in Esther, the letters YHWH are found as an acrostic. Now, let me state up front that these acrostics in Esther are not foolproof. This is not official doctrine. I think this is an interesting insight to look at. I point them out here because I think it's interesting that we don't actually see the word God in here, but if you look at the acrostics, they're there. And nobody would argue that. Someone who might dispute it would say it's just a mere coincidence. And there are, I would say that, there are detractors who say this is merely a coincidence. Now what I've done here, I'm going to read you a few of these. I've taken this acrostic commentary here from the Companion Bible. They have an appendix in there that has this set of acrostics. So again, this is not official doctrine, but it's, I think, super interesting to see that perhaps the writer included the name of God in here after all. The first acrostic is found in Esther 1 and verse 20. I'll read it to you in English. And when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his kingdom, great though it be, all the wives will give to their husbands honor, both to great and small. That was Esther 1 and verse 20. That's up front when they're giving him advice. If you look at the phrase, all the wives will give, in the Hebrew, we find that the first letter of each word spells out YHWH backwards. Why? Because God is overruling and reversing the wisdom of man. Whereas it was man's intention, this decree causes women to do the will of men. What do we actually find happening in this book? that God ultimately uses the will of Esther to guide the king. So that's the first place that you find this acrostic. The second one is found in Esther 5 and verse 4. And here it says, Esther said, "If it seems good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." And the phrase, "let the king and Haman come this day," in Hebrew, the first letter of each word spells YHWH going forward. Why? Because God's hand was upon this feast that he might defeat Haman. The third one is in Esther 5 and verse 13. It says, "This all avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the gate." The phrase, "yet all this avails me nothing," in the Hebrew we see that the last letter of each word spells YHWH backwards. So you'll notice that all of these are slightly different. The final letters are used here because this is the beginning of the end of Haman's plot. And the name is backwards because God is turning back Haman's plot. Next we come to Esther 7 and verse 7. This is the final one. "And the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman remained to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king." And if you look at the phrase, it says that there was evil determined against him. In Hebrew, you'll see that the last letter of each word spells YHWH forward. The final letter is because Haman's plot had come to an end, and forwards because God was moving the plans of Esther and Mordecai forward. You'll notice here, whenever a Jew speaks, the name of the Lord appears in a correct sequence. It's in the forward sequence, which is right to left in Hebrew. I'm doing it wrong by doing it this way. And whenever a Gentile speaks, the name of the Lord is reversed. And you can see the pairings. So we talk about pairings. Two acrostics on the initial letters, and two acrostics on the final letters. Two acrostics by Gentiles, two acrostics by Jews. And the reverse names tie in with the reversals that we talked about, the ironic reversals that make up the book. The irony lies in the fact that both Esther and Haman spoke on their own initiative about their own schemes, but in their speaking, who was really doing the acting to promote Esther's success and Haman's failure? It was God. By this literary device, the author tells us in a hidden way how God worked in a hidden way to save his people. Now, was God absent, or was he working invisibly behind the scenes? I think whether you even dismiss this acrostic thing or not, it's incredibly obvious that God was indeed providentially guiding and directing the events in Esther to his will. And that lesson for us could not be more important for us today. The takeaway, like I said, you know, particularly those of you who are struggling or suffering or feeling disconnected from that God is around, that he's just left us all, is to go home and really ponder and reflect. Is God absent in my life? Or if I pay attention to it, is he visibly working behind the scenes? Invisibly working behind the scenes. You know, read and reread Romans 8 and remember that God has always worked out his promises, even if it doesn't appear so on the surface. So that's the first takeaway that you can get from this book. The second point, and there's probably lots of takeaways. These are just ones that I thought were interesting and, you know, a matter of reflection. The second is to look at how this book shows us small actions can have massive world-changing effects. So the second reflection I want you to take away today is to consider your life and the power of your small actions and how this incredible interconnected design that God orchestrates, in the end, he orchestrates it all, yet allows small actions to have these massive ripple effects. We call them the butterfly effect, if you've ever heard that phrase. The butterfly effect is defined as a property of chaotic systems, such as the atmosphere, by which small changes in initial conditions can lead to large-scale and unpredictable variation in the future state of the system. I think we're mostly familiar with the butterfly effect. It comes from that the wings of a butterfly could actually create a typhoon, by how they just small actions affect the greater outcome. So, how is that relevant from this book? Why are we getting this from this book? Notice that this book gives us little genealogical clues to both the protagonist and the antagonist of this book. Why does it do that? In chapter 2, in verse 5, it tells us that Mordecai is the descendant of Kish, father of Saul, first king of Israel, Benjamite. It also tells us he's a descendant of Shimei. Anyone remember Shimei? I had to go back and look. I thought I remembered him. Who was Shimei? Well, he was a Benjamite. If you remember the story of David when Absalom was starting his revolution, and this guy comes out and curses David when he's fleeing. You remember that? And it was this guy named Shimei. Now, the thing on Shimei is, after Absalom is beaten, he comes back and asks and begs for forgiveness from David. And David grants him forgiveness. You know, perhaps if it had not been for the grace of David, Shimei would have never had the lineage. Maybe Mordecai maybe never would have existed. And certainly if he would have, you know, the standing, you know, it probably wouldn't have led to Mordecai's connection to the royal family that we read, you know, as he was carted off, his family was carted off to Babylon years earlier. One act of forgiving grace by David had a massive butterfly effect on the future of his people. He would have never known that at the time. Small act of forgiveness eventually led to Mordecai. On the opposite end, this book reveals to us in chapter 3 and verse 1 that Haman is an Agagite. Does anyone know what that means? Well, if you go all the way back to the story of Saul, who Mordecai is related to, first king of Israel, what was the downfall of Saul as king? There are many things, but what was the moment when God finally declares through Samuel that his throne would be removed? Do you remember? What happened? What did he not do? It was when God had commanded Saul to completely annihilate the Amalekites. Because they constantly harassed and attacked Israel. And Saul got clear instructions, and he didn't complete the task. In fact, he even saved the life of one King Agag. It's clear that some of Agag's children and then descendants survived. And here we find them, seeking retribution hundreds and hundreds of years later, seeking retribution from the annihilation of the Jews. And like a first attempt at the Holocaust. You know, this small, tiny, little, rationally sound act by Saul, disobedience by Saul, led to an existential butterfly effect outcome. And how ironic that is Saul's descendants here in Mordecai and Esther, who finally right the wrong on Agag and the Amalekites. But this should cause each one of us to reflect here. How our small actions forever change the world. Forever change lives. And do we use that for good or evil? Now, I think sometimes we just get caught up into, you know, we're one person out of 8 or 9 billion. We're too small. We're too small as a congregation. What we do doesn't really matter. By the way, God's orchestrating it all anyways, which he is. But he uses people to do it. But that's not true. What we do matters. It matters almost to, like, if you think about this, to epic proportions, even in small things. And it's important to think that way. Because if you can guide your small actions, they add up to a lot of other things. Like I said, God, it's true, God is the master orchestrator. And in the end, just like Mordecai said to Esther, in the end, his grand purpose will be done, with or without us. He'll get the job done. But the question for us is, are we choosing to be part of that purpose or not? In this upcoming year, you, each one of you, will likely interact with thousands of people in one way or another. Which means even in a small congregation like this, roughly 50 people here today, that's going to impact the lives of 50 to 100,000 people this year. Maybe in a small way, but you interact, you come into contact with them. And you know, each of those 50 or 100,000 people, as they work, this, if you play it out, you're touching millions and millions of people with your small actions. Maybe in small ways. But I ask you to consider, as we start a new calendar year, how can you use your small actions to serve God's butterfly effect purpose in the year ahead? So that's your second action. Think about that. What are the little things you can do? We came back from Winter Family Weekend, and I talked to the guy who was running it. Of course, I had a little bit of this in my mind, and I said, you know, there was like 1,000 people there. But people meet people and get married out of that. People make friendships or hear something that's encouraging that changes their life. There's a butterfly effect that happens from something that small. Think about that in your life, the small things, and how it can make an impact. The third big takeaway from the book of Esther that we want to reflect on today, and this is the final one. It's an obvious one, and you might even say, well, it's pretty similar to the second one, and it is. But it's different in a way that I want you to reflect specifically in a third way. Before we get to it, turn back again to Esther 4, verse 13 through 16. I said we'd look at this again. It's the most famous passage in the book. I flip over to the New King James Version even for part of it because I just like the way that is memorized. It says in Esther 4 and verse 13 through 16, I'll read again. Mordecai sent this reply to Esther. For if you remain completely silent at this time, your choice, Esther, you can remain completely silent. And if that happens, Mordecai was convinced that relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. He knew that God had a grand purpose, and he's the grand orchestrator, and it was going to happen. And he said, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows? Who knows, Esther? Whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Who knows, Esther, if this is the whole reason God kind of set up all these things? Didn't you ever notice it seems strange for an unknown Jewish girl to be the queen of the country? Maybe this is why that happened. Who knows? If God placed you in that exact place, an exact time, for this reason, where you could be involved in his orchestration of his purpose. And Esther replied and said, as we read earlier, gather everyone together and fast for me 3 days and three nights. I'll do the same. And even though it's against the law, I'll go see the king. And if I die, I die. You know, the third real takeaway here is God has a plan for you. Satan has a plan for you. And you have a choice of which one of those plans you're going to follow. Now think about Esther's situation here. Let's go back to Esther a little bit. Think about her situation here. She was queen. She had servants. She was insulated from everyday struggles. And while there was a threat from this edict, surely she could have rationalized, even though Mordecai said this, surely she could have rationalized and said, I'm going to be okay. It was probably, if she's sitting there doing the math, it's probably riskier. Her odds of dying are probably higher if she goes into the king and asks for this than if she doesn't. But when Mordecai gives her that message, it appears from what we read that Esther recognized something. What he said struck her. She recognized that she had been created for a purpose. She recognized that this was a fork in the road, not just for her, but for her people and for history. And when Mordecai challenged her with the rallying cry for who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this, she knew the simple answer. God had placed her there for this purpose. And while it doesn't mention God directly, notice what Esther does next. What are her next steps? She humbles herself. She fasts for 3 days. She asks for the Jews to do the same. She fixed her purpose, no matter her own personal outcome. You know, what she really did here is demonstrated in dramatic fashion three core characteristics of God and his sons. She demonstrated humility, faith, and love for others above self. And that is a tremendous example for each of us. Now remember, as you go about your daily, ordinary life, that God has a purpose for you. So really, the third takeaway I want you to reflect on today is God using you in your life? Wait, actually no, that's the wrong question. It's the wrong question. Because if you're in here, if God's Spirit is either in you or it's working with you, then God is using you in your life for his purpose. So the real question is, how is God using you in your life to serve his purpose? How? What ways? In what way are you glorifying God and bringing honor to his name with how you serve other people, how you live your life, how you walk in his ways? With the examples you set, like I mentioned earlier, with the literally thousands of people you interact with here in 2025. How are you part of the grand orchestration? How is God using you in your relationships with others? How is God using your gifts and your talents to serve his purpose? I want you to reflect on that for a bit. I really think you should reflect on that. I'm going to reflect on that. It actually leads to another question. Probably will lead you to another question, which is really your homework I give you. Really your call to action. Your real call to action here, and everyone here has to do this. I'm going to maybe check up on you. Go home. Get on your knees and ask God. God, how can you use me to serve your purpose more? So not just how is God using you, but ask him how he can use you more to serve his purpose. Ask him to show you the way. What talents and gifts do I have? What else do I have to offer? What should I be doing in my daily life? Give me the courage to do it. Some of this stuff takes a lot of courage. Tell God you want to bear fruit for him. Ask him to show you how you can be part of his great commission and how you can be a son or daughter that glorifies him. Ask him how you can be a part of his great purpose. What are ways that he can use you more? Uses maybe even the wrong word. He invites us to be part of his purpose. It's an honor and a privilege to be used by him. And perhaps if you behave like the persistent widow with that prayer, and you connect with the Word of God regularly, and you exhibit faith, humility, and love for others beyond yourself, like we read Esther did, perhaps you will hear his still small voice in your life. Perhaps you'll find yourself in situations where you realize, who knows whether you've been put in this place for such a time as this, in certain spots in your life. You know, God has a purpose, and he is the master orchestrator, but he wants you to be a part of it. And if you get nothing else out of this message, I want you to reflect on how God is and how God can use you for his great purpose in the year ahead. So, all I ask of you today is to take just these three reflections and reflect on them, ponder them, think about it. What we read in the book of Esther, and hope it stirs up some thoughts. You know, God may seem invisible, he may seem not present, but he is with you and he will keep his promises. Reflect on the ways he has been and continues to be quietly visible in your life. Second, remember that your little, small, tiny actions ultimately affect the lives of thousands and 10,000s and hundreds of thousands and beyond. And God can use that as orchestrator in powerful ways. And finally, God has a plan, and he has a plan for you as an individual. He is using you for a purpose. And ponder on that today. How is and how can God use you for his purpose further in the year ahead? You know, at some point or points in each of our lives, we're all going to be faced with dramatic challenges. At a fork in the road, perhaps. You know, the New Testament says that that's just the way it's going to be for every son of God. But when you do, and when you're afraid, and when fear is paralyzing, I challenge each one of you to remember and echo Mordecai's rallying cry. For who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And then respond, humility, faith, and love for others above self.